Hey, welcome back to A View from the Couch. My name is Rich.
I'm Jen.
And we're here to talk movies. And today, the movie we're talking about is 2018's Antlers. Or, no, is it 2019's Antlers? 2020's Antlers, right?
2021,
that's right. I'm sorry, this moved so many damn times, I can't remember what year it came out. I'm kidding. I know it came out last year, but it moved a lot. If COVID wreaked havoc upon this film, as it did with many others, it's been filmed since mid-2018. It was ready for release in 2019, so I exaggerated a little bit. But and then 2020 came along, and 2021 came along, and end of 2021, they finally released it. So what do you know about this movie? Before we went into this, what did you know about this?
I didn't know anything about it. It wasn't even on my radar of anything to see.
This showed up on my radar as soon as they released a trailer for it back in, I want to say it was 2019 when they released a trailer for it. Whenever that first trailer came out, I saw it and I thought, holy shit, this is my kind of movie. And I mentally checked off a box that said, remind me when this pops up. And it kept getting moved and moved and moved. And then it went to theaters in 2021 and we were going to go see it, but we ended up not going to see it in theaters. Such is life.
No, I think it came out in October.
Yeah.
And I think we went and saw a couple movies, but we weren't going on a regular basis yet to go see movies.
No, we weren't. I think the only one that we went and saw while we were down in Florida was Halloween Kills, if I remember correctly. We had planned to go and see another one. And in fact, I think we had planned to go and see this movie, but we balked on it because COVID was kind of rampant at the time. It still is, guys. It still is. Get the jab, be safe, wear a mask. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not here to preach to you. I'm here to talk about this movie. Jen, who made this movie?
All right. This movie was directed by Scott Cooper. Now, Scott Cooper has directed other films such as Crazy Heart and Black Mass.
Yeah. Now, Black Mass is that one with Johnny Depp, I think. Isn't that the gangster movie,
and he
right?
Plays Whitey Bulger, I think it is.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then this was written by Henry Chasen, Nick Intosca, and Scott Cooper. And it is based on the short story, The Quiet Boy, by Nick Intosca.
So it is based on a story.
It is.
Okay.
All right. This movie stars Keri Russell as Julia Meadows. We have Jesse Plemons as Paul Meadows. Jeremy Thomas as Lucas Weaver. Sawyer Jones as Aiden Weaver. Scott Hayes as Frank Weaver. And we have Graham Greene as Warren Stokes. Amy Madigan plays Principal Ellen Booth. And I think that's going to be our main cast. Yeah, I think that looks like our main cast there.
All right. Now, question for you. This movie is about, we'll get into it, but it's basically about a Native American boogeyman, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Why are these all white people with the exception of Graham Greene? There's no indigenous people in this movie. They're all white people.
That's a good question, because the director, Scott Cooper, he said when they were writing it, he really wanted the Wendigo, you know, because there's a Wendigo stories in lots of different cultures, but they wanted to stick with the Native American version.
Yeah, they make sure to tell you that it's the Algonquin legend. In fact, Graham Greene is the one that he plays the mystical Indian guy, spoken in context, guys. I know that that's not the appropriate terminology, but, you know, in the parlance of film, the mystical Native American guy, I guess. And he tells you all about, you know, the Wendigo. Mm-hmm. Tells the white people about the Wendigo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. I didn't think of that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. We'll get into that, I think, a little bit more as we get into the movie, because there is, man, there's some there missed opportunities in this movie. But so starts out in a you can tell right off the bat that it's in the Northwest, right? Could you tell them putting up that it was in the Northwest, that it was in the Northwest?
Not right off the bat, because one of my first notes was, wait, where is this taking place? But as we were going and then you start seeing the scenery and stuff, it's like, oh, this has got to be the Northwest.
Sure. Yeah. I had it picked as the Pacific Northwest, like from the first shot, like that shot of like the trees leading right up to the water. I'm thinking there's not many places like that. And they still put up the title card. Obviously, they want us to know exactly where that is. Interesting side note. I hope I'm not stealing your thunder here, but this is filmed in the same place that First Blood was filmed. The original movie First Blood with Sylvester Stallone. The original Rambo, before they started whacking out the names and calling it all kinds of different things. Anyway, but it starts out in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, I think specifically, and in a mine where a guy named Frank Weaver is running a meth lab while his 7-year-old kid waits in the truck, right? He's cooking meth while his kid waits in the truck with his buddy. The kid doesn't have a buddy, but Frank has a buddy. But he and his buddy are attacked by a mysterious creature while they're in the mine. They hear noises and they go to investigate and they see all these like pouches and stuff hanging, right? And then they get attacked by some creature. And then we cut to what turns out to be several weeks later and a different kid, but in my mind, somehow it was the same kid, right? I didn't pick up on that it was a different kid until a little later.
Wait, what?
Oh yeah, I know, right? Weird. But
are you sure? I thought it was Lucas that was at the truck with him.
No, that was Aiden at the truck with him. You see what I'm talking about? It's completely wacky. The way that they cut this, it makes it seem like we're seeing this kid. And the kid looks visibly older, but I thought it was further in the future and it was this kid older. And we're going to deal with like what happened in that mine that, you know, that he saw or he heard or whatever. But that's not who it is. It's the brother. It's the older brother of that kid.
Right. Okay. I'm going to have to go back and watch that now.
I rewatched it.
Wait, what? Because I thought, yeah, it was Lucas that was at the truck with him. And then we're following Lucas because it seems to be Lucas's story.
I know, right? But they establish it right off the bat as Aiden, with Aiden and the dad. Mm-hmm. And then they cut to Lucas's story.
But that does make more sense because Aiden is the one that gets ill.
Absolutely. Yeah. It does make sense, but like it's jarring at first because my brain followed it to the future for some reason. I thought, okay, so we've got the 7-year-old here and now he's more like 9 or 11 maybe. Mm-hmm. And so this is in the future from where we were, where we started, but no, that's not the case at all. This is simply just a few weeks later. And
okay. Yeah, yeah. I didn't pick up on that. So I apparently wasn't paying attention.
No, it confused me. It confused me right off the bat. And maybe I'm the only one, but I feel like it was edited in such a way and the kids look so much alike that the one kid looks like an older version of the younger kid. And that just threw me off.
Yeah, they definitely look like they could be brothers.
Right. Well, which works out really ultimately in the grand telling of the story, it works
good
out.
Casting.
But it totally messed me up. Now, I did one of the things that I liked about the opening though was the when they're in that mine, the dad and his meth cooking buddy, when they're in that mine, there's actually like fire going on or something. And you learn later that that's like a sign of the Wendigo. Right. And then when the kid goes to look, when Aiden goes to look, he walks towards the door to the mine shaft. Mm-hmm. And like, there's like embers, like, you know, like floating in the air, but they look like eyes looking at you in the darkness. I thought that was kind of a neat little effect, gave it a little bit of a creep factor. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely thought that kid was pretty brave for walking in that dark place by himself, because I wouldn't have done it.
No kidding, right? So we pick up later with Lucas, and he's wandering around picking up roadkill and going back to his house with it. And his teacher, Julia, kind of starts to notice like strange behaviors and weird drawings and stuff like that. So she tries to bond with him. She takes him for ice cream, which I thought was an interesting, tack on her part to try and like coax out of him what was going on, right? Mm-hmm. We see her in the liquor store, in the grocery store at one point, and you see that like she's looking like longingly looking at the booze and choosing the gum over the booze, right? So obviously it's being set up to be this whole like cycle of abuse thing, right? But she feels like some sort of like Peter Tingle about it, right? Where she feels like she's got to try and bond with him to try and like protect him, you know?
Right. She basically says because of her history and her past, mm-hmm. she feels that she can see the signs.
Yeah.
You know, she sees how he's behaving and, mm-hmm. you know, the drawings and stuff like that. So she, you know, wants to try and step in and help him out.
Right. Well,
so it all makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And it all, I mean, it comes to light because, you know, we find out that her dad was an alcoholic and an abuser. And the whole reason that she's even back there is because he's committed suicide, right? Like he killed himself some weeks ago or something. And she came back from California to stay with her brother. So she's living with her brother, who's Jesse Plemons, right? Jesse Plemons, mm-hmm. Didn't we just talk about him? No, he's in The Irishman, which we pre-recorded
mm-hmm.
for later this tax season. Yeah. So Jesse Plemons is going to show back up in our show later, guys. He's kind of everywhere, that guy.
He is.
Yeah. So
this is also the third time he's played a sheriff in these movies. So
really,
it's a recurring role for him.
He's good at being a sheriff. Is that what it is?
I guess.
Good job, Jesse Plemons. Way to go, buddy. So we have like these little like. There's this scene where she's playing the piano, and there is a creepy dad moment where like a ghost version of him comes up and puts his arm around her, and you almost feel like it feels very skeevy, you know, like mm-hmm. I kind of got the grossed out, you know, kind of a thing going on there. It was, yeah. There's,
well, I think you're supposed to, I mean, they're showing that she was sexually abused by her father.
Is that how you took it? Because I took it as just,
I took it that way.
Okay. Yeah.
I did, because there was, you know, different, I mean, when you see the hand like that,
yeah,
you know, I mean.
Oh yeah. He puts his hand in her shirt, doesn't he?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there was another little vision she had where it was like
him naked on the bed, right?
Yeah, or didn't he touch her leg or something like that? So, I mean, to me, I took it as she was being sexually abused.
Right. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I had it in my mind for some reason that it was just like physical abuse, like beatings or something like that. But you're absolutely right. Now that I'm thinking about it, he does put his hand in her shirt, like mm-hmm. Ghost Dad puts his hand in her shirt. And that plays heavy in this film, right? Like the idea of passing on like this generational trauma for her, for the kid, for, you know, for basically everybody, right? Like there's a lot of poverty in this film. The brother talks about having to evict another family and their kids and let them get some stuff, and then he has to take them out of there. And so like that is also a form of trauma, that's an experience that's traumatic. This whole movie is just steeped like tea in trauma, you know?
Well, there's a reason for that. I mean, that whole thing is all that negativity and everything is supposed to be what is drawing and giving birth to this Wendigo, basically. And then this Wendigo is drawn to the weakness in people or stuff like that. And so that's why, you know, I don't know if it came across in the movie so much, but I watched some interviews with the director and then Guillermo del Toro, because he's the producer. And that's kind of what they were going for was, you know, this Wendigo attacks people who have a weakness inside them. And so this drug addicted father, you know, got possessed by this thing.
There's his
and
weakness.
The child is a child. And so they're going to have a weakness.
Right.
That part I thought, yeah, maybe you're stretching because you can have some strong children, you
sure,
know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I wasn't sure about that one. And then, you know, we see at the end that Paul Meadows has been infected and they don't really.
Hey, spoilers. Damn.
Well, we're talking. Well, I mean, I don't want to have to bring this up again later and go, hey, remember when I was talking
about? No, I'm kidding. That's what, that's what this is about. So talk. I'm just kidding. I'm just messing with you.
So he gets infected. And I guess where I get confused here is, you know, if this is supposed to be infecting those who have a weakness, I think what we're supposed to take is, you know, he's taking those pills. And so is that for a health reason? Or is that something he's also maybe addicted to? But there's a moment that I picked up on where Paul and Julia are talking and Julia, you know, is basically saying, you know how bad it was for me. And Paul says, you don't know what it was like for me.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of led to believe that Paul was probably abused too in some sort of manner. Now I would assume his was maybe more of a physical abuse, but we don't know that because they never tell us.
Yeah. We don't ever
but
hear his
because
part of it.
He gets infected at the end. I guess I'm kind of trying to put two and two together to think, okay, he probably has some sickness too, or like a weakness where maybe he hasn't dealt with his past also, you know?
Okay. All right. Okay. You know what? I like this a little bit more now with that. Okay. I would have liked this more, I think, if we had that more prevalent in this, the fact that the Wendigo was specifically attracted to these types of problems. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I would have not picked up on this unless I watched those interviews. Mm. And I feel like they maybe should have done something a little more to convey that. I mean, obviously you don't want to just outright say that because a Wendigo is a fantastical creature. It's being born at this point. People aren't supposed to have tons of history on this thing. You just have your thoughts and mythologies and stuff behind it. And so how you get that across, I'm not sure, but I do like that it was drawn to, you know, these certain people.
Yeah. I mean, it gives it a whole reason for existing, right? Like what did it come from? Where was it? Obviously it was there all along because they had those medicine bags up, right? And those medicine bags, like that's one of those things that Lucas hangs on the door in his house, right? Obviously has something to do with warding off the Wendigo or warding off evil spirits or something like that. Again, more Native American like imagery and thought processes with less Native American people involved. I feel like this story might have been a little more impactful if we had a Native American cast and it dealt with the trauma of the Native American people and how the Wendigo relates to it and how it, you know, what, like, I mean, you could make the argument that the Wendigo is vengeance of the Native American people for white people, you know, expanding west, taking their land, killing them off, all the horrible things that, you know, settlers and expansionists did in this country, right? But that isn't how they describe it, you know? That's not how they describe the Wendigo. The Wendigo isn't that, you know?
Right. And that, and their take on this isn't exactly what the Native American take is. It's close. The Native American has, you know, it's kind of got a background with cannibalism and stuff.
Right. But
they did add in that the dad actually didn't take the form of the Wendigo till he actually consumed human flesh. It was at that point that he actually burst through. He had enough energy to come forth as the actual Wendigo creature versus before he was just eating animals.
Okay. That makes sense to me, actually, because the only other thing that I knew about a Wendigo was in Marvel Comics. And there's a character called the Wendigo. And if you consume human flesh, the Wendigo will take you and you'll become the Wendigo. So that actually makes sense to me. That actually makes sense to me. Hmm. Well, okay. So let's go. Let's keep going with the story. Julia first goes to Lucas's home and hears some weird noises. And we find out that Lucas has been keeping his dad and his brother locked up. This is where we really kind of get to see what it was that was up there. He's been feeding them the roadkill that he collects. And while this is all going on, the former sheriff, the guy that's played by Graham Greene, he finds the mangled remains of a human body, which we later find out is actually, like, I think it's the buddy of Aiden's dad, the Frank, right?
That's who I take it as, because as far as I know, the Wendigo is now inside Frank.
Right.
And he's been locked up in that room. So I was like, wait a minute, where's this body coming from?
Where did this come from? Yeah.
But I feel like that must have been the original attack. And then the spirit went into Frank, maybe. I don't know. That part, I'm not really sure. We don't see it. I'm not sure what happens there.
Yeah. They don't really give us an explanation. Does his buddy, his meth lab partner, get murdered? And then the Wendigo takes Frank, or did Frank turn into the Wendigo and then kill his buddy and then, you know, didn't know enough to consume anything at that point, but just killed him and, you know, slaughtered him or something. I don't know. They don't really explain it.
Right.
But they find the remains. And meanwhile, Julia is, like I was saying before, she's pressuring Ellen into going to see Frank going to see the Weaver house, basically. So they do this thing where, like, Ellen's going to the house. Paul and Warren, the former police sheriff, discover more remains in the mine, and Ellen hears noises in the house. So she breaks in and breaks into the room and finds Frank and Aiden.
Mm-hmm.
And while this is all going on, Lucas is, like, drawing stuff in the school, right? He's in school and he's, like, drawing stuff furiously, right? And it's this very ET moment, which was kind of weird in, like, given the nature of the film and given the way that they've set this up and his relationship to them. Like, he didn't, it was almost like there was a psychic link there. Like, he knew what was going on, but they didn't really establish that. You know what I mean? It was just kind of there.
Yeah. And again, we go back to the body in the cave. Whose body is this? Where is this coming from?
Yeah.
Again, was there a creature that went back down the cave and there's just part of it got into Frank? That part's where I get kind of confused. Like, what is happening? I don't follow where Frank picked this up, but yet the thing is gone and not around, you know?
Yeah. 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 I feel better just thinking of that as his partner, because we never see the partner again.
Mm-hmm. But then who's the guy in the forest?
That's only half of them.
Okay. So maybe half of them's in the cave and half is in the forest.
Yeah. Well, I mean, didn't you notice it was only, like, legs?
Because it started looking kind of gross. And so I looked away from the TV.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. But yeah, there's, like, a leg and like a foot, and that's it.
Okay.
But then when you see it in the cave,
way more sense.
Yeah. Yes. When you see it in the cave, there's, like, a hand and, like, a shoulder that you can kind of make out. So I took that as there's half of a carcass in the cave and half of it outside of the cave.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
okay. I'm okay with that then. That makes sense.
So once Ellen busts into the room and finds Frank and Aiden, Frank kills her and eats her, which is what we were talking about, right? He cannibalizes her. And that's when the Wendigo comes out of him.
He's got enough power now to come forth.
Exactly. Yeah, come forth, right? It's basically antlers, right? It's like these thorny antler things that like just burst out, and they burn it. It burns its way out of Frank's body in this very like strange and gory fashion, right? And then later when you find like his like shed skin, like a snake skin laying there, it's all smoldering and everything. Yeah, that was pretty gory too.
And the whole front is like burst open where the like came through.
And like a very like chest burstery feeling. There's some good makeup effects. I agree with that. So then he, you know, he eats part of Ellen. He runs off, and he runs into Lucas and the bully, the guy who's been bullying Lucas, and he ends up killing the bully. So I guess that's good, right? I'm not saying all bullies have to die, but like, it's better than eating your own kid, right? I guess is what I was getting at.
Do you think that this thing still has some of Frank in it, or is this just the new Wendigo that used Frank's body as like a cocoon or something like that?
That's how I took it. I didn't take this as having any of Frank, because there's a spot where like when it transforms, there's like, it's got Frank's face on it, and it just like slides off of it to reveal like the beast, right? Like that last vestige, that last piece of Frank falls away. There is no more Frank. There's only the Wendigo. That's how I took it. So I think it's just fortuitous that he killed the bully instead of the
kid. Took it that way too. But, you know, Lucas later feels that his dad is still in there, you know?
Yeah, he does.
But, you know, yeah, it's probably just a kid having hopeful wishes and stuff that, you know, dad's still around, I suppose.
And that's a trauma thing too, right? Like, you know, your dad is, you know, beating on you or being vicious or whatever, or being a horrible creature. And you just, there's this hope that there's your dad is still in there, like somewhere deep inside, there's this part of him that still loves you and doesn't want to do these things to you and still can be saved. Right. So there's something to be said about the trauma of that, or this being like the exploration of that type of trauma, you know?
Right. Right.
So, yeah. But he, so he runs home, and then he finds his dad and his brother are gone, and Julia visits the Weaver's house, finds Ellen's car, the cops come, they discover Ellen's body, and they find that Lucas is gone. They take, or not Lucas is gone, Aiden is gone, and they take Lucas to a hospital. And at the hospital, Lucas, they tell, the doctor tells Julia and Paul that he's malnourished and dehydrated, and he shows signs of having been abused for years. She decides she's going to take him in, and they go back to her house. Well, no, because didn't they? Yeah, no, they go back to her house, and then they go to Warren with the drawings that he made, right? Because they took Lucas's drawings to Warren, to the former sheriff, right?
I think that was earlier.
Was that earlier?
Yeah, I think it was.
Okay. He identifies the figure in the things as the Wendigo, and he does the, you know, he does the whole tell them about, you know, that it's a ravenous spirit and it jumps from person to person. You can only kill it by removing its heart, setting up the end of the movie, basically. Right. Yeah. Lucas gets discharged from the hospital when he finds out that Frank's dead. He tells Julia that Frank is coming for him, and he's going to try and take him down to the mine shaft to be with Aiden. So they hole up in Julia's house, and Frank's, or the Wendigo, attacks the house and kills one of the sheriff's deputies, wounds Paul, and Julia,
which, by the way,
yeah,
that sequence there, I think I jumped about a foot out of my chair. It was a fantastic jump scare there. It was, it was a good one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
not a lot of jump scares through here, which is nice. I don't like movies that's just jump scare, jump scare, jump scare, because that gets a little tedious. But I think there's like maybe two or three in here, and that was a good one.
I think what's great about this movie is that it's not it doesn't lean into jump scares or gore. It's a combination of all those things, psychological mm-hmm. horror, gore horror, and jump scare horror. It's like the gift basket that you get when you move into town. You know, it's got like all the different types of horror. That's the, yeah. I don't want to move to that town. So Lucas runs away as soon as he gets a chance, right? Even though Julia is trying to keep him safe, he takes off because he wants to go to the mine to find his brother, right? Mm-hmm. And Julia and Paul follow, and she finds Lucas and Aiden. He sees that Frank has, or they see that Frank really has become the Wendigo, and they fight. She fights it, and she ends up killing the Wendigo and mm-hmm. pulling its heart out and everything. Lucas helps her with that. But then the Wendigo spirit passes into Aiden. Mm-hmm. And Julia has to do what's kind of the unthinkable and take care of that kid as well. So she stabs him, takes the heart out. And we believe that that's the end of it. But later, like you mentioned, Paul, you know, kind of starts to have this cough, and he ends up coughing up like black goo, which is what happened to Frank when he first got possessed. So we know that the Wendigo isn't gone.
Yeah. Right. So I really enjoyed the progression of Frank while he was getting sicker and sicker, and the makeup, and it was really creepy watching Lucas tried to go in and feed his brother, and the dad was there. And at the time, we didn't know that that was dad, and that dad was, well, we maybe knew it was dad, but we didn't know how much dad actually tried to save Lucas here. So you're very worried for Lucas through this whole film in here. And, you know, you see these scenes in the bedroom, and that would be terrifying for a kid. Right. And he doesn't say anything to anybody. He keeps us all to himself and tries to take care of them, you know?
You want to hear?
I thought the makeup was very good. The progression of the dad losing the hair, and you could definitely see where it was taking over him more and more every time we were seeing it.
Yeah. What I think is really dark about the situation that Lucas finds himself in is that he's probably been trained by his dad to not say anything to anybody about anything because his dad cooks meth.
That's true.
So he's hiding this because that's what he's been trained to do.
You know, and also they do talk about how they've looked at taking those kids away from him before, but they keep getting placed back with Frank because they don't really have anywhere else, or they think that's the, you know, best place for the kids to be, which that's really kind of sad.
Yeah. It's interesting that this movie plays a lot on the failings of the system, the trauma that the system is part of, and a generational trauma of, you know, abuse. I mean, you see the idea of the actual passing of the abusiveness from one generation to another, right? With first with Aiden and then later with Paul, right? Because his dad was abusive to him, and now he's got the Wendigo in him, which is the representation of abuse in this scenario, right? Like that's how I took it. So like, I read it as it's supposed to be an allegory, I think, because it transfers from person to person. Right. And so does abuse. Abuse is a cycle. If someone abuses a child, that child is going to be prone to abusing their children or other people. And that's just going to perpetuate until somebody stops it. And the way that I took that was, you know, Paul ends up with that in him, right? He has that ability now to be abusive. Not that it's a good thing, but it's interesting that they didn't do that with Julia, though. Like, she gets skipped over. And I wonder if it's because they go to kind of great lengths to show that she took off, she left. That's a source of tension between her and Paul, that she left and abandoned him, right? There's a mm-hmm. there's some guilt there and some hand-wringing about that. And I wonder if the fact that she departed and took herself out of the scenario is supposed to be, hey, this is how you break the cycle, is by getting away from this.
Well, they also show her that she is struggling with like the alcohol thing, mm-hmm. but she doesn't partake.
She never gives in. Yeah.
She doesn't give into it. The fact that she's trying to help others get out of those situations, you mm-hmm. know, I feel like, yes, she is getting herself out of that.
Yeah.
And her brother, Paul, he seems very angry in this, and he's kind of still in that. He hasn't healed from this yet. He hasn't made his peace with it, I guess, if you want to say that. But
he's still stuck in the same town. He's stuck in the mm-hmm. same house that he grew up in, where the abuse happened. I mean, mm-hmm. he's still harboring all of that.
Yeah. I don't know if I necessarily agree with the fact that the Wendigo is a sign of the abuse passing down. I mean, it's an interesting take on it, but I just don't know if I think that that's what that was saying, but you know, it's, I guess, one way to look at that. I mean, it sounds like it could have a ring of truth to it.
It's all about interpretation, right? I mean, it's art. Mm-hmm. So it is to you what it is to you, right? And to me, it just says to me a lot about abuse and that cycle, you know?
So. Yeah. But see, here's my thought is I feel like if he wouldn't have gotten stabbed with that thing, it wouldn't have gone into him. I feel like there's got to be some kind of physical something besides just it's going to pass to you. I think there's got to be something there. And so that's why I feel like he got hit with it, not necessarily just that it passed to him, you know?
Right. I think that the way that the film stands, that's a good read on it. I think when you look at the special features that you read, that you watched, that said that that it's drawn to this weakness, that the other interpretation makes sense as well. And I think they were trying to go for that allegory, but mm-hmm. if they were going to do that, they needed to make it more clear that it was going to go into whomever, no matter what, you know, that it was going to be drawn to that no matter what.
It would have made more sense than if they didn't stab him with the antlers. Although that was a very scary, I mean, this is a horror movie, so you got to have some of that horror stuff in there. So that's, I'm sure, why that was there. But if they would have kind of skipped that and it still went into him, then I would say definitely, yes, I would agree 100% with what you're saying.
That's a good point though. I mean, in your interpretation, if he hadn't been stabbed, he wouldn't have turned it. He wouldn't have been starting to turn into the Wendigo. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's how I took it.
Okay. I think that's a viable read as well. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it's not right or wrong. It's just we saw the movie. So
it's art. That's how it is.
Something else with the movie I wanted to talk about is just the look of it. I really mm-hmm. liked the muted tones. It had got darker mm-hmm. colors to it. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't see anything that talked about any kind of certain filming things they did with it. I'm sure there is things that, you know, cameras or lenses or coloring or something that they did on there. But I thought it looked really neat and it did add to the creep factor of this whole movie.
Yeah, definitely. It has this drab, rundown look to it that
which gives goes you, with that town,
right? Yeah, I was just going to say that it gives you the feeling of the town quite a bit, and the idea, like, you go to the Weaver house, and it's run down. It's not like falling apart, but like there's little signs of it being like a rundown house, right? And like it's all like the muting of the colors just accentuates that, I think.
So, mm-hmm.
yeah, definitely. Definitely. Good call. Do you have any other notes that you wanted to hit on before we move into what I'm sure is going to be a very interesting Jennifer's Trivia Tidbits?
Oh, you're putting a lot of pressure on me, but yes, I have some trivia, but no more notes.
Okay. All right. Well, let's hear it. Now that I've laid the pressure on you, what are some trivia bits? What do you got?
All right. What do I got? All right. The narration at the beginning of the film is mm-hmm. in the Ojibwe language.
Okay. Wait, why? Shouldn't it be in the Algonquin language? Because they're talking about the Wendigo being Algonquin. Or are the Ojibwe part of the Algonquin?
Oh, I have no idea.
All right. I'm going to have to look that up. You go ahead. I'm going to look that up.
All right. The rest of the stuff I have is on the special effects of the Wendigo itself. Now, they tried to go with a lot of the practical effects. So it's basically a giant puppet that they use. And then when there's fighting or it's moving fast, that's when they bring in the CGI components. So for the physical look of the Wendigo, Cooper, Del Toro, Mahan, and concept designer Guy Davis, they all got together and they really wanted to try and pay homage to the Native American folklore. So they really kind of leaned into the look of this thing based off that Native American folklore. And with that folklore, their Wendigos are deer-like and have the antlers. And so that's okay. where we get this antlers from.
Interesting.
They wanted it to represent two things, the destruction of our natural resources. And so that's why it has that dark coal-like look to it. Like okay. it's coming out of the center of the earth or out of like the lava part. So it's got like that dark look to it.
Yeah.
And then it's also a metaphor how we're destroying not only our bodies and our minds and our souls, but also the earth in general.
Hmm. They put a lot of thought into that creature. I mean, and it shows too. I mean, it is a very distinctive looking beastie. You're not going to soon yeah. forget it. I'll tell you that much.
Right.
While you were doing that real quick, the Algonquin, the Ojibwe are part of the Algonquin peoples. The Algonquin are the most
okay.
populous and widespread North American native groups, or one of the most, and the Ojibwe are part of them.
Okay.
So
makes sense.
I stand corrected.
All right. So for this giant puppet, they mechanized the Wendigo's head and neck, which were positioned above and forward of the performer's head and mounted to a backpack rig.
Oh, Jesus.
The neck was then on a device and the whole head moved independently. And it was operated by a remote control.
How heavy was that friggin' thing? Because that would have, I mean, yikes. A performer was wearing that?
Yeah, a performer was wearing that, and then the head movements and stuff were like remote control. So they had like a smaller one that they were showing on the behind the scenes stuff that they remote controlled, and it looked really cool. So then they just made, you know, a bigger one to go on top of the performer. And like I said before, the intimate shots, the close-up shots, stuff like that, they did with practical effects.
Yeah.
And anything physical, anything moving, that was all CGI.
So there was CGI. Okay, because the practical mm-hmm. stuff was amazing. Just absolutely. And I am a huge fan of practical over digital effects. Any day of the week, I would take a practical effect over a digital effect. And that's just the 80s kid in me, right? That's what we grew up with. But I could barely tell that there were CGI in this. Where, like you said, you just said that, like the further away stuff, like the wider shots.
Well, if they were doing motions like falling down, jumping up, moving fast, doing the fighting, okay. that was all CGI because there's more movement and the physicality of trying to get that big rig to move okay. like that was just probably, I'm assuming was just not going to work, but.
Sure. Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense. That makes sense.
And that's what I have for trivia.
That's it. That's all you got, huh? Okay. All right.
That was good.
That was all right.
That's,
I mean,
all I've, you got.
Look, I've heard better is all I'm saying. So.
All right. I'll try harder next time.
Do better. Do better. You're going to find out, though. Like, we're going to find out if you did better because we've already pre-recorded stuff that's coming after this and we'll see. Did you do better? I'm just kidding. You do a phenomenal job. Who am I kidding? You do a great job of presenting that information. Anything else you want to add before we go into our version of our recommend?
No, I think I've covered everything.
All right. So here we go. Jen, do you keep, do you rent, do you erase antlers?
I'm going to rent this one.
Okay. All right.
I liked it. Mm-hmm. I will probably watch it again. But there was a couple things that were a little confusing for me. As far as recommending it to people, I would say if you like creepy, like creature movies, like creature horror movies, this is probably up your alley. Go ahead and watch it.
Sure.
If you're not into scary movies, don't watch it. But hopefully you've already seen it if you're listening to this. But right, I think I'm going to put it on the rent. I think it's better than Erase. It's not worth erasing. I think it was good. I think it was interesting, but probably not something I'm going to keep. It's probably not something I'm going to pull out on a regular basis to watch over and over again.
Okay. I hovered with this one. I really did. Somewhere between rent and erase, or not rent and erase, excuse me, rent and keep. And I think what teeters it towards rent for me is the fact that they really missed an opportunity to have a Native American story told about Native American peoples and the effect of and like their situation in this country today. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They really missed that. They missed a shot at that, and they went straight for like white people problems. And well, not white people problems, because look, abuse is everybody's problem, but you know what I mean, right? They went for a mm-hmm. white cast when they could have gone for a cast more in line with the story that they were telling, which is a story about a Native American boogeyman. That being said, I agree with you. I think that this is worth a rent. I will probably watch this again. I've seen it twice now. I'm sure I'll watch it again. It'll probably happen around our Halloween time. This is one of those movies that, like, if I want a horror movie that's going to have a little bit more to the story, a little bit more for me to actually digest rather than, ooh, look how cool that kill was.
This right. is the it's kind not of stuff a slasher film. It's right. It's got a little meat to it on there. I like your take on the Native American side. I think with them, with listening to their interview and how important it was for them to represent that part, I feel like they did miss that opportunity to bring in a Native American cast. So I agree Definitely. With your take on that.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think I'm safe saying rent on this one then. So there we have it. Two rents. Again, I'm with you. If you want to watch a scary movie, this is fine. It's good. It's somewhere between like a Midsommar and a Pumpkinhead, right? Like Midsommar being like this really heady, you know, horror movie, this like elevated horror film, and like Pumpkinhead being like this old fashioned, like visceral practical effects, like gore fest. Right. So this movie sits somewhere in the middle of that. So
sure.
Depending on how you feel about those types of movies, there you go. All right.
Sounds good.
So what's next?
All right. Next week, we are going to cover Last Night in Soho.
Last Night in Soho, the Edgar Wright flick, the next Edgar Wright flick. Like, you know, okay. So Quentin Tarantino talks that when he like advertises his movies, he's like the 10th film from Quentin Tarantino or the 8th film from Quentin Tarantino, as if like we're all keeping track. The one that I'm keeping track of is Edgar Wright. So like, the next film from Edgar Wright is the way that they should do this, but he doesn't have the ego that Quentin Tarantino does. So I'm looking forward to that one. Hopefully it's good.
I agree. The preview or the trailers look really good. So I'm hoping it will be interesting.
Yes, yes, definitely. All right. So we will see you next week right here on the couch for Last Night in Soho. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to A View from the Couch. We value your feedback. Please consider leaving us a review on Podbean, iTunes, or your preferred podcast listening app.
You can reach us on Facebook by searching at A View from the Couch, on Twitter at @view_couch, or by emailing us at aviewfromthecouch@yahoo.com. Thanks again for listening. Bye.
See ya.